I've been trying to book today's guest since I read an article of his last August about restructuring the Federal Reserve. And that is William Grider, author of Secrets of the Temple, which I think is one of the best books on the Federal Reserve. And interesting, that prophetic book was written 1989, I believe. For some, the Fed is at the center of all that ails us, and there's a movement to audit it and a movement to abolish it. For others, Chris Dodd, for instance, Barack Obama, it's the right place to house any new financial regulatory powers. Well, not any, but the prime agency in the new financial regulatory powers that we're going to try to put forward as a result of the current crisis. Now, interestingly, there are 32 co-sponsors for Senate Bill 604 and House and 317 co-sponsors for House Resolution 1207. These are both bills to audit the Federal Reserve, and over 95,000 people have signed a petition to that effect at www.auditthefed.com. Just yesterday, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit in New York ruled the Federal Reserve, or I guess Friday, ruled the Federal Reserve must disclose the names of banks that could have collapsed if they've not received emergency loans. The Fed has been fighting that, and the lower court had ruled that they would have to release these names, and now the U.S. Court of Appeals has said the same. As I've said, William Grider wrote perhaps the finest book on the Federal Reserve, and he always seems to keep an eye on its too secretive and too powerful ways. He challenged Greenspan and Paulson long before it was fashionable, and he was right. Now national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine, William Grider has spent 40 years examining how powerful institutions affect ordinary people. For 17 years, he was the national affairs editor at Rolling Stone magazine, and he's the former assistant managing editor at The Washington Post, where he worked 15 years as a national correspondent, editor, and columnist. He's the author of national bestsellers One World Ready or Not, Secrets of the Temple, Who Will Tell the People. He served as correspondent for six frontline documentaries on PBS, including Return to Beirut, which won an Emmy in 1985. Most recently, he wrote the introduction to Meltdown, How Greed and Corruption Shattered Our Financial System and How We Can Recover, by the editors of The Nation, and Come Home America, The Rise and Fall and Redeeming Promise of Our Country. Welcome again, William Grider.
Thanks, Terrence, and thank you for your persistence.
Yes.
We've exchanged a lot of messages.
We have. I have a file, you know, of the back and forth, and it's exceedingly long.
I never said no, remember?
That's right. Exactly. And I never gave up. I mean, it was amazing to me yesterday when I was preparing the show, and I saw that that original article that had piqued my latest interest, because we spoke actually last February. But my latest interest was piqued by that article about a call to restructure the Fed, and that had been in kind of July, August of the summer.
Yeah.
Okay. So as I've said, today I want to focus on the Fed. If we have time towards the end to get to other stuff, maybe look at some of the maybe Dodd's proposal for financial regulation and some of that sort of stuff. We're one of the few public affairs programs probably not talking about healthcare today, and I will try to stick to that. You wrote Secrets of the Temple, as I said, in 1989. What's
87, actually.
87?
87, yeah.
Wow. What sparked your interest? What brought you to write about the Fed at a point when I think, aside from, you know, those folks, that sort of small group who have always opposed the Fed, it really wasn't on people's radar too much. Although that was the time of the savings and loan debacle,
yeah,
wasn't it?
I have a very concrete explanation for that. I was the AME at the Washington Post running the national coverage in the dawn of the Reagan era, 1980 election and afterwards. Had an arrangement with David Stockman, Reagan's budget director, which some people remember, where we met privately every other week or so and talked about what was happening in the advance of the Reagan agenda. And that turned into a piece I wrote for the Atlantic magazine called The Education of David Stockman, which in which he basically revealed that he had lost faith in Reaganomics because he could see it collapsing around him in the politics. But during that year, 1981, where I'm both directing coverage and staying very close to the players myself, it dawned on me after a few months that actually Reagan wasn't the most important story. The really fundamental story happening to the American economy that year was Paul Volcker at the Federal Reserve. And he had taken over in late 79, appointed by Jimmy Carter. He just jammed on the brakes, took interest rates way up, and induced a long and deep recession. And I said to myself subsequently, gee, I don't know anything about the Fed, and I've been in Washington for 20 years. I know a lot about the federal government, but beyond the usual cliches, I don't understand this institution. But I now have had a glimpse of how powerful it is and how it's really excluded from political discourse, except for a few crackpots.
Yeah.
Nobody can talk about it. What's this about? Isn't this a book? And that's literally when in 1982 I'd left the Post and I was setting out to write for Rolling Stone and write books, and that's where I chose that subject. And I emphasize my innocence because the deeper I got into it, I realized that I wasn't just looking at a political institution; I was looking at the bloody core of American capitalism.
Now, you also have a WilliamGrider.com. Do you still tend that?
Not very much.
Okay.
Started it with this latest book. I basically revised another website, which had been pretty comatose, too. I'm going to change that, I think. I've got to do some tinkering with my web designer, but I think I want that site to be a home for not my newsy blogs. I write those occasionally in for the Nation website, thenation.com, but a place where I can post longer, slightly more meditative essays that I write, and be a kind of catalog for a wide range of ideas, not just about the Fed and monetary policy, or even about politics, or where I think the country is. That's actually the subject of my latest book, Come Home America.
Right, right. Yeah.
We won't get off into that, but it's a kind of, I hope, gentle and helpful description for people of how deep a hole we are in, and that this is the country that emerges from this ditch, and I'm talking about more broadly than the financial crisis, is going to be different from the country we knew for so many years. And it's going to, that passage is going to be painful. I stick to my optimism.
Right.
And insist that we can be a better country on the other side of the ditch. And I think this book I wrote just as the financial crisis was blossoming, if you can use that word. And I think I was a little premature, frankly, in how quickly the public at large, never mind the governing types, could grasp the reality of what was happening to us.
The deeper reality.
Yeah, the deeper reality. I mean, I was kind of assuming that, well, here, the bomb has gone off. Everybody will now know what I'm talking about. But I think many people still don't. And they're kind of in a denial, which I understand and sympathize with. But I almost wish that book, the book is out in paperback, I say, to plug it. But I almost wish it were published first time right now or even next year, because this is a really hard blow Americans have taken.
Yeah, I must say, William Grider, I had the same feeling. In other words, when the book came out, which is when we did that that interview in February of last year, was right around its release, and it did seem like, wait a minute, I know the impulse, because what comes out in that book for you is things probably that you've stored up for years, but that America wasn't ready yet to recognize the depth of things and thus the possibility of change. And it is, I mean, but on the other hand, here we are over a year later, and as you say, even now might be premature. What, just while we're talking about it, what do you make of that? of America's or the American public's or the American media's or whatever it is.
You know, let's leave the media aside for a moment. They don't help, but I think your listeners probably already know that.
Yeah.
But we don't have to dwell on it. But I think, and I've always tried to take a longer frame historical view of things, which gives me sympathy for people trying to cope with what's new and understand it. And here, as I try to suggest that we're at the end of a long and mostly glorious run for this country that started literally with victory in World War II. And we don't have to go through that whole history. There's some very dark passages in it as well, we know. But nevertheless, American prosperity became not just fabulous, but also widely shared.
That's the word I was going to say. Yes, that was the era of the American middle class.
That was the good time. And my message, which makes it so hard to sell, is the good times that we knew are not coming back. This is not just about do we get out of the Grand Recession or do we start even creating jobs again and have wages at least not keep falling and so forth and so on. It's deeper than that. The business model for American prosperity that more or less worked for most of the last 50 years is gone. It's busted. And I urge any of your listeners to test this, either from their own experience, but it's more easily answered if you talk to young people. And when I say young, I mean, you know, 18 to 30-ish. And ask them what their reality is. And I guarantee they will bring you up to date, because that prosperity model has been busted for them for some years now. You're experiencing a lot of the symptoms in California now,
mm-hmm.
as the bubble of our prosperity shrinks. They're piling more of the costs on the young people.
Yeah. Yeah, and as California had a bigger share of the bubble, so
well,
it has.
But, and California also, let's be fair, did more for young people in its good years than almost anybody else in the country. They built this fabulous educational system. You know the story, and that's coming down now. But for some years, even generous California has pushed costs off on young people.
Yeah.
And that's not just at UC Berkeley, but it's at all of the, not just state schools, but the community colleges, and push it down the line. That's why I say, check me out with young people. And not that they've read my books, but they know their own reality, and they will tell you in fairly blunt terms that what they're told by their elders, people like you and me, is bunk. And it has been bunk for a lot of years. You know, the standard, and California again is the model. Go to school, get more education, get a good job, and if you do all those right things, in a few years you'll have a family and you'll own your own home, et cetera, et cetera. And what happens to the people who do that? And I'm not just talking about the super educated, but you know, sort of middle working class. It doesn't. There's no piece of that which comes out true anymore.
Yeah.
And I'm not stating anything that hasn't been reported before, but I don't think those of us who are a little bit older have quite absorbed the profound difference that has already emerged, even before this financial crisis. The financial crisis, alas, makes it worse.
Yeah.
Because we have lost, we, the country, has lost trillions of dollars in wealth. And whether that was in banks or in people's pension funds, savings, or the public treasury, it's the new reality we're now dealing with.
Yeah. Okay. Let me just we're going to
write a story.
Yeah, yeah. So that was us briefly talking about William Grider's latest book, which is Come Home, America: The Rise and Fall and Redeeming Promise of Our Country. And we're not going to probably return to that, but I do recommend it. And maybe the next time my persistence pays off, we'll talk again about that one. But we're going to try to focus on the Fed because I say the Fed, where you said when you wrote that book in 87, it was because no one talked about it, no one thought about it. That isn't the case today. The Fed is in the news, and you're an expert on it. Just in the last couple of days, as I said, was that that decision by the circuit court, by the appeals court, that the Fed does have to release disclose things it didn't want to disclose, and that the number of sponsors. When you wrote your article, I think there were 250 House sponsors of that bill to audit the Fed, and now that's up to 317. And then the Lehman Brothers revelations of a week ago seem to put the New York Fed and Timothy Geithner in the middle of some of the unsavory parts of that. And so people are talking. And then, of course, Dodd's proposal for financial regulation places the new protection agency within the Fed. So people are talking about the Fed. What I want to do is get to those bits of the very, very current, but I also want to look at the history. So for people for whom the Fed is newly on their radar. When did the Fed come into existence? What was the movement that brought forth the Fed? What was the argument at the time? And what was it charged to do once it was brought into existence?
Well, the reality that broke over the head of our Federal Reserve Chairman, Ben Bernanke, through no fault of his own, but the events of the financial crisis literally tore away the mask. And I mean by that the mystique of intimidating superior expertise that protected the Fed, the central bank, from real scrutiny and real political discussion. And people in the governing elites would blame that on a lazy public that doesn't pay attention. The truth is that that general ignorance was in the design from the beginning, 1913, when Congress approved the creation of a central bank called the Federal Reserve System. And the reason they wanted to do that was because the country, 100 years ago, was in tumult and very serious political conflict surrounding these issues of money, the currency, the bank, the power of the banking system, who had access to credit and who was denied access, all of those questions. They were a rich center of political debate. And it is literally true that citizens a century ago, or even in the 19th century, had a knowledge, albeit a rough knowledge, but they understood why this was important to them, and they understood the political implications. So when the banking system, led by J.P. Morgan and others, famous names, finally decided that for their own sake, they had to create a central bank, which they would partly control, but not totally. Washington had to help, because it was just too big for even J.P. Morgan. So when they do that, they design this beast, patterned after the Bank of England, as a semi-secret institution that can only decide these large questions in privacy. And what they were doing, quite deliberately, was cutting out the public. And it worked. The money question, as they called it in that day, gradually disappeared from American politics. Now, you stand back and think about that. It is extraordinary. So that when I come along, 60 years later, and don't have a clue, even though I'm intensely interested in government and I understand a lot about it, I don't know much of anything about this institution. And I wasn't alone, was I? The general public, likewise. And what happened in the last 2 years to me was quite exciting, exhilarating even. When the Fed started bailing out big banks in such a visible way, and it pumped out trillions of dollars, average Americans said, what's that? Why was
Yeah, where did that money come from? Who's in charge here?
Where did that money come from? And I would say, well, the Fed created it. That's what central banks do. What? What do you mean created it? I mean they typed the keyboard numbers in, and that money began to exist, and they handed that out to banks. So you see, I was quite thrilled by this because, as you know from my earlier, The Secrets of the Temple was an attempt to earnestly explain this institution, and I take some credit. A lot of people read that book. They're still reading it, I would say.
By the way, let me mention this, by the way. I happen to notice that on Google Books, you can, if you're willing to read it in PDF format on your computer screen, read the entire book for free.
I didn't know that. I didn't know that.
I
may have to talk to my agent.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to ask you whether I should announce that, but I
to buy the electronic version?
Yeah.
It was electronic.
Yeah.
Well, let's leave that aside.
Right.
My point is, and I've written this different ways in The Nation. I have another piece that I'm shopping around now. I literally think this is the watershed where Ben Bernanke, as I put it, reminds me of the Wizard of Oz.
Mm-hmm.
When little Toto pulls back the curtain and you see Frank Morgan in the control booth frantically turning dials, pulling levers.
Mm-hmm.
That's what happened to the Federal Reserve in the last year and a half, 2 years. And Dorothy, I think, says something to the effect of, his voice comes ringing out from the screen, "Silence, the great Oz has spoken." And Dorothy says, "Nonsense, you're only a man pretending to be a wizard." That's what happened to the Fed.
Yeah.
To my delight, obviously. But it's a moment where we have a chance, only a chance, to reopen the question of democracy. Because I make the argument, which naturally all so-called responsible people will deny, but I nevertheless make it because I now know quite a lot about the Federal Reserve. And I've followed it over 30 years, and I make this provocative argument. Democracy could have saved us from this collapse. I'm convinced if the Federal Reserve was subjected to the normal give-and-take of politics, that is, public debate, people taking different positions, arguing over the policy making that the Fed presides over, we wouldn't have had this Wall Street catastrophe. Because the Fed, instead of being worshipped, would have been embattled. And you know, a normal kind of politics would flow from that.
So you're saying, and what's interesting to me, William Grider, is that the institutions that are, you know, quote, more democratic or more transparent, like the Congress, etc., haven't done such a good job themselves. But what you're saying is that the shift from complete mystery to even debate and conversation might have saved us.
Well, I go even further than that. I think, and I wrote this actually in the book 20 years ago, and I'm writing it again now. The effect of introducing the central bank in the terms that our country chose reduced average citizens to children and made them ignorant. But it also reduced members of Congress to a similar role, kind of cranky, powerless children. And the Federal Reserve was the father figure. It was wise, remote, and stern, and it would make these decisions behind closed doors and wouldn't bother to explain it to the public because it knew the public wouldn't understand them. You see what I'm getting at?
Yes, yes, okay.
And this is more than psychology. This is the power relationship built into our society. And it means, in effect, that technocrats, the governing elites of technocratic expertise, but also the powerful interests who can afford to that sort of thing, have a kind of top-tier democracy where they, you know, they debate this stuff among themselves. Some of it's public. A lot of it's just at good dinners. But the rest of us are down below on the bottom deck. And we are quite purposely kept in the dark.
And what's interesting is actually the argument at the appeals court and the argument kind of the argument repeated over and over again is still the same. That
right.
you have to keep these things secret. It perils our economy if people were to know what banks are talking to the Fed about infusions, et cetera, who we've given money to, et cetera, et cetera. They still hold to this thing that we will all be better off if we, the mysterious wizards, take care of you and if you mind your own business.
And even though you will complain now and then, we will ignore your back talk because we know you don't understand what you're talking about. And that's a conceit, Terrence, that goes much more broadly than the Federal Reserve.
Yeah.
It is built into what I call technocratic governance.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, present in a lot of levels of government, not just Washington. But I offer the gleaming example, most tarnished example, which is Central Intelligence.
Yep, that's where I thought you were going. Yeah.
And think about what we confer on the CIA.
Yeah.
It's very similar, isn't it?
It's
sort of, well, they know things that we don't
exactly
know, so we have to trust their judgment because they can't make this information available to us. It's classified. You wouldn't want to share it with the enemy. You know, all of those elaborate processes they've built up over the years, and the CIA literally has the ability to stampede this nation into war.
How is the U.S. system similar or different from other central banks?
Well, it's similar to the central banks in the leading countries. And originally, as I said, modeled after the Bank of England,
right,
which was not exactly a small T democratic nation then or now, frankly, but. The European Union, or the European Monetary System, has a European Central Bank with very conservative values. Again, its functioning reality isn't all that different from the U.S., but it's a very different history. They have what I think I would, and most people would say, is a very hard conservative view of currency values and how they must be maintained. That grows out of a lot of bloody history, and most dramatically Germany's just devastating inflation back in the 1920s after they'd lost World War One, that led to essentially the collapse of civil government and Hitler, the rise of fascism.
Right, so let me just say, when you're saying conservative, you mean truly conservative, not right versus left.
Yeah, no, not at all.
They shy away from risk, and that they
also, but we also would add, those societies, mainly because of the bloody realities of World War II and fascism, have a very different understanding of social equity than we do.
Yes.
And we could go on at length about that, but you know what I mean. They spend public capital on a lot of enterprises which this country does not yet accept as necessary.
Right.
Now we're in the midst of the healthcare debate there, I mentioned it, which is a small, very, very modest step toward what Europeans and Japan for that matter already have.
Right.
So I think it's an unfair comparison to say, oh, well, they're not that different. Well, they're profoundly different.
As you say, they may not be different in their functional rules, but in their philosophies and what they actually do, they are. My other question, just because it's, you know, the Fed is such a mystery, what is the role of the 12 regional privately owned Federal Reserve banks? And I know that in that article that I referred to, you comment on the fact that where they're placed shows how out of touch the Fed is. But right. What is the role of them?
The original idea of the Federal Reserve System was, and you have to remember, this was done in an era before telephones were really transatlantic or transnational. They had the telegraph, but there was nothing in terms of video or et cetera, et cetera. And gold moved by ship and train. So the problem was, as the country expanded, the reserves of banks were maldistributed across the country, and the banks would fail, they believed, because you couldn't get the reserves there fast enough. in that setting, they decided, well, we need 12 regional banks holding reserves of banks all over the geographic country. Now, that is utterly irrelevant today, one should understand. Nevertheless, these institutions have some prestige, etc., and above all, they are part of the Fed's political base. You put the movers and shakers on the local board, you put the best and leading bankers on the local boards, and all of them become a claque for the Federal Reserve and its privileges. That leave the politics aside. I think it's it was a dubious hybrid at the beginning, but now it is an absolutely corrupt hybrid. To say we're going to have this regulatory agency that polices the banking system and makes it behave, but we're going to let the bankers share in that process of decision making and so forth. If you were inventing a central bank today in this country, I rather doubt that you would repeat that conclusion. So that's
although
one, that, it's the 12 regional banks are not as powerful as many presume. The decision making is now, thanks to the New Deal reforms, centralized in Washington. It is true; it's shared with these local sub-branches, but it's not. But basically, the chairman and the seven-member board of governors has the center of controlling policy.
Yeah. By the way, that one thing you said is that if they were setting such an institution up today, you doubt that the bankers would be. Let me just read a couple of things from your article. Bankers are the shareholders who ostensibly own the 12 regional Federal Reserve banks. Bankers sit on the boards of directors proposing interest rate changes for Fed governors.
Yeah.
And bankers also have a special advisory council that meets privately with governors to critique monetary policy and management of the economy, so the bankers have all this power. You say that if they were doing it today, they might not do that. But if they were doing it in the middle of the bubble, when everything looked rosy, perhaps they might have. Do you know what I'm saying? It seems that right now would be a time when people would raise questions, but perhaps 6 years ago, 5 years ago, perhaps they would not. Okay.
Let me take it a step further.
Very good.
And this is an accusation I laid out in broad form in the book I wrote 20 years ago, but the subsequent 20 years have really confirmed my judgment then. What the Federal Reserve did in the last 30 years, starting in 1980, was to go to extremes. It chose sides. It chose sides in ways that benefited capital and punished labor, that favored stock market and financial investments over wage earners.
And over industry.
I can go on and on in this way, but this was an unusually harsh ideological shift that the Federal Reserve underwent in trying to tamp out inflation and so forth. But then it went on to favor deregulation of banks and very stern control of the real economy, that is, slowing it down, which would keep wages from rising. I did explain a lot of this in the book, but it got worse after that book.
Yes, well, I remember, I mean, where I began to first notice some of this was that during the period when Greenspan was being venerated as the maestro, as the genius, etc., you were writing articles intermittently explaining exactly what you were just saying, that he was not neutral, he was taking sides, and that he was hurting, he was helping the big numbers, but hurting so many people. And can you describe a little bit for those, again, who might not understand, a specific example of how that was done, how the way they handled interest rates, for instance, favored finance and hurt working people?
Well, I, in the Nation's pages, used a phrase which was a bit of a caricature. Nevertheless, I would argue it's accurate. I called Greenspan the one-eyed chairman. One-eyed because he saw price inflation in the real economy and the danger, so-called danger of rising wages, even when they didn't exist. And so he would tap on the brake being higher interest rates, and slow down the U.S. economy, keep it from growing faster, which would lead to full employment, and full employment is the right condition for generating rising wages. The workers have better bargaining power, whether in unions or not. Meanwhile, he was blind to the really ferocious inflation of prices in financial assets, better known as the stock market, as housing, bonds, all of the things we've now gotten educated on. They went through the roof. And it didn't just start in the last few years, as the story is being told now. It really started back in the 80s, and then in the 1990s, when Greenspan was in charge, he made it far worse. And these were his ideological convictions, and I assume sincere. But they did enormous damage to the U.S. economy and to people all over. And here's the nut of my complaint. The American people, if this is a self-governing democracy, the American people are entitled to know these things. And that doesn't mean they'll always understand them correctly or that they will even care or pay attention, whatever. But that's a right of being an American, to be able to hear the contesting views and the political consequences for ourselves.
And the economic consequences.
When a government agency does this to people, it at least ought to tell the people what it's doing to
right,
them.
Right, right. And the
Fed is exempt from that. Now, the Fed isn't alone. A lot of other agencies of government get to keep secrets, too. But it's just, that's why if you, people hear a little outrage in my voice, it's about that. Because I have a considerable confidence that if Americans at large, they don't have to be experts, but they have pretty reasonable common sense understanding. If they get a general picture of the way what government is doing, they can fight it out from there. They'll make some wrong choices, but on the whole, that's better than leaving it to secret experts.
Let me just read a couple of quotes, if you will, from a site that I believe is called Abolish the Fed or something like that. I just kind of Googled because I know that there is a minority movement in this country that is more outraged than you and feels that, you know, not that it should be transparent, but that it should be eliminated. Let me read a couple of quotes just so I can get your take on whether what they're saying is accurate. Fair enough?
Yeah.
Okay. Who owns the Fed? This is reading from that website. The Rothschilds of London and Berlin, the Lazard Brothers of Paris, Israel Moses Seif of Italy, Kuhn, Loeb, and Warburg of Germany, and the Lehman Brothers, Goldman Sachs, and the Rockefeller families of New York. Did you know that the Fed is the only for-profit corporation in America that is exempt from both federal and state taxes? The Fed takes in about $1 trillion per year tax-free. The banking families listed above get all that money. Almost everybody thinks that the money they pay in taxes goes to the U.S. Treasury to pay for the expenses of the government. Do you want to know where your tax dollars really go? If you look at the back of any check made payable to the IRS, you will see that it has been endorsed as pay any FRB branch or general depository for credit U.S. Treasury. This is in payment of U.S. obligation. Yes, that's right. Every dime you pay in income taxes is given to those private banking families commonly known as the Fed tax-free. What's true, what's not true in that?
It would take me an hour and a half to sort through the juxtapositions and leaps of conspiratorial faith that you've just read. I will make it crude and simple.
Very good.
Basically, that is a fantasy of people who have genuine fears and about the power of the central bank. Some of what they are citing, as it suggests, goes back centuries and has some figure of anti-Semitism floating over it. I won't go into any of that.
Right.
I will say, this issue has been litigated. The Federal Reserve system, notwithstanding all that you've read about who owns the 12 regional banks, is government. It's a part of the federal government. And people of good intentions don't want to believe that, partly because they can't believe that their elected government did this to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I go cut to the chase and say, get over it. This was the Federal Reserve System was created by an act of Congress. And as acts of Congress do sometimes, it created, in effect, authorized, chartered private organizations. And so the 12 banks, because the bankers wanted it that way, are chartered. Constitution Avenue, and it's maintained. Its life and death depends upon the Congress. If people want this cleared up, go to the Constitution, Article 1, which is about the Congress. Section 8 gives the power to create money and regulate its value to the Congress, not to the White House, not to the Treasury, doesn't mention even a central bank. And so I want to return to first principles and say what needs to happen is that Congress needs to reclaim its authority in the Constitution to supervise the creation and regulation of money. Now, it can delegate that, of course, because the members of Congress are not going to count the bills on the floor of the House, but that control would necessarily restore democratic principles to the central bank function.
So you're saying it's in the Constitution. They have basically
Congress
given it up. The
yes,
same way they've given up the authority.
This thing that they created called the Federal Reserve System. My point is, every advanced industrial nation that has a currency, most do, will have a central bank. It has to have somebody who does the money creation process and regulates and so forth and so on. So I'm not against having a functioning central bank. What I'm against is setting it outside our democratic accountability and the usual principles of who government must answer to.
Very good.
Government is supposed to answer to the people.
Let me go back then now to the article that I originally cited. It was either July or August. I have two different dates. But it was the one that I think the title here is How the Fed Prints Money Out of Thin Air. And you make a point there that they are talking about giving the Fed more power. For instance, if they lodge this regulatory agency within the Fed and so on. You said, and I'm going to read a quote, you say, a few months back I ran into a retired Fed official, and you said to him, we think this would be a good time to dismantle the temple, I playfully told my old friend, democratize the Fed or tear it down, create something new in its place that's accountable to the public. He did not react well to my teasing. He got a stricken look, et cetera, et cetera. You then state six reasons why granting the Fed even more power is a really bad idea. I would like you to go through those and how you think it should be restructured, and we've got about 8 minutes or so.
Well, I can't even remember the six in order.
I'll give them to you.
I'll give you the essence of them.
It would reward failure.
It would reward failure, and I've already explained how the Federal Reserve, and people I think still do not fully appreciate this, they know the Fed screwed up by regulation of the banks and letting the big boys go crazy. But their monetary policy was also, as I've said, skewed drastically in one direction to the great detriment of most of us and to the country as a whole. Why would we trust them with even more supervisory power? This, another reason is that the Fed is in a profound conflict of interest as to what its role is. Is it supposed to defend the public interest against the bankers, or is it supposed to help the bankers be profitable and therefore stable? It kind of swings back and forth on which of those are priorities. And then I go on with some other...
Well, I'll tell you. The Fed policy was a central force in destabilizing the U.S. economy.
Yeah.
That's what you just said. And as you say, it was not just that it didn't regulate the too big to fail banks. What it did with interest rates, it did with other things, ballooned the bubbles and finance and shrunk industry and working people's part of the economy. Right? And then you say the Fed... can't be trusted to defend the public in its private deal making with bank executives. That's kind of what you just said. You say that it serves two masters and it's kind of schizophrenic, but would it be safe to say that the bankers, when push comes to shove, that the bankers and the banks and stability for the banks and for finance and for Wall Street seems to always win?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And here's when we get to the legislative proposals, and Barack Obama advanced this whole idea. Basically, he said, well, we can't fix all of the parts that are broken in the financial system, so let's turn it over to the Federal Reserve and let them clean up the mess. And that's literally what the president has proposed. And the Congress is a little ambivalent about that because a lot of senators and representatives are pretty pissed at the moment about the Fed and its secrecy and all the rest. But you can see why that's a dangerous idea. And I say this with some sympathy to Fed governors. You're asking them to take on this powerful client of theirs and do to it things that the Congress, the politicians, and the president don't have the nerve enough to do,
uh-huh.
Which is change the financial system.
Right.
I mean, that's the way the mess will be cleaned
Let
up.
Me see if I can rephrase that. You're saying that you've got folks like the president and the Congress who are funded by financiers and bankers, you know, in through campaign donations and lobbying, and they won't even take it on. And you're saying they're saying to the Fed, who actually includes the bankers as one of its powerful pieces,
yep.
You do it instead. And you're saying while one has trouble because of their conflict of interest, the other conflict of interest is much larger.
Yeah, and also the dangerous part is that if you give the Fed this power, they will ostensibly be considering, as the language of the legislation says, if a financial firm is doing things which seem dangerous to the system, we will tell them to stop, basically. And I ask, first of all, how plausible is that? But secondly, if they don't stop and these institutions get in a similar crisis, the Federal Reserve is supposed to resolve that, allegedly by shutting them down, but I think that's not really very clear. I think we will get back, despite denials from the president and the Fed and the Congress, we will get more too-big-to-fail bailouts. And guess what? That's what the market people think, too.
Right. Okay, so what would...
The people who want the Fed in charge are the same people who want the banking system to go on pretty much unaltered.
If Congress chooses to take charge of its constitutional duty, as you recommend, what would the restructuring of the Fed that you foresee as positive look like?
Well, it could take many different forms. I'm not wed to the exact details, but I think you could even keep the name Federal Reserve if that gives people confidence in the dollar or whatever. But basically, you would recreate an accountable agency of government and cut away all the banker insider stuff and cut away all of the secrecy rules. It's perfectly okay for an agency of government not to reveal commercial secrets, for instance. Regulatory governments deal with that all the time. But at some point, they've got to reveal the process of their decision-making. And you can do that in a pretty timely way. And that'd be the first rule. I would then say you have to also do some serious reforms in Congress itself so that they begin to have a genuine regulatory oversight function that actually does keep track of the Fed, not in the sort of rhetorical propaganda terms, but in the way any Fed watcher in the marketplace would look at the institution. I mean, this is a little bit of what drives me nuts on the subject. Reporters, if they wished, could do approximately the same thing I did, which is to, first of all, really track carefully what these people say and do, but then go out into the financial world, bankers, business people, investor firms, bond houses, and talk to the participants there. Most of them are relatively, they don't tell you dark secrets, but they will tell you what they see happening. And then you write about it. You see what I mean? To demystify the institution, mm-hmm. and regularly, not just once or twice a year, but regularly report the Fed is pushing its policy this way, and people say it will have the following consequences for ordinary mortals.
And finally,
describe that. You know what? Why should this be a secret?
With
the government's doing it. You know, they would do that in other subjects. Why not do it in monetary policy?
With really very little time left, less than a minute, the idea, I think, is that what you're saying, when we talked about the European banks, that they have a different philosophy, and so they use public money for other things. Is your vision that the Federal Reserve would be a public bank that might be put to better use, public funds for infrastructure, for investments in the country and so on, and might there then also be, as there's a movement now, public banks in states and municipalities?
Yeah, that piece I wrote last summer, system in toto, where they create and multiply its volume, you would take a portion of the new money creation and devote it to orthodox monetary views, always denounce the greenbacks. People at large, however, understood that that's what kept the economy booming through the Civil War, and it was shut down afterwards to the ruination of American farmers, et cetera, et cetera. My point is, if you could get a responsible stewardship in the Congress, you could then move to something similar in the modern era, in which instead of simply creating money and turning it over to the banking system in toto, where they create and multiply its volume, you would take a portion of the new money creation and devote it to, very publicly, to specific projects that the government is going to build or wants to build for the broad general interest. I think of high-speed rail. You can harness the money power to broad public.
Right, and not just to giving it to the banks. Okay, so again, the websites are thenation.com and williamgreider.com. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly. You can do that either at iTunes or at terrencemcnally.net. You can go to terrencemcnally.net to learn more about past podcast transcripts, the whole notion that this show is based on. If you want to get my weekly email of upcoming guests and issues, you can email me at temcnally@mac.com, temcnally@mac.com. You can also do that on the website at terrencemcnally.net. Thank you, William Greider. Keep up the good work.